From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. More than 1,900 American soldiers have now died in Iraq. That new marker came this week. The U.S. has been at it for 2.5 years in Iraq, and the end is not in sight. This weekend in Washington, peace marchers will demand a pullout, but even strategists who believe the U.S. must hang in say America needs a new strategy. Strategist Andrew Krepinevich says, shift quick from chasing insurgents to building secure zones. Then stick with it for 10 years and many billions. Today, we'll hear his view and more. This hour, On Point, looking for a way out of a bad situation in Iraq, looking for a new strategy. Later in this hour, we will check in on Hurricane Rita, now a Category 5 storm. And we're working the phone lines to Baghdad. We expect to hear from Time Magazine's Michael Ware there, the bureau chief who's recently been in the midst of battle. Throughout this hour, you can certainly join us. With more than 1,900 American soldiers now dead in Iraq, what is not working here? Is there a better way or just the way out? And are you prepared for a 10-year war that will cost hundreds of billions of dollars? Do we have a choice? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Andrew Krepinevich, Executive Director of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments and professor at George Mason University. His article in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine, How to Win in Iraq, has caused a stir in foreign policy circles. Andrew Krepinevich, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
Also with me in the studio today is Barry Posen, professor of political science at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he's affiliated with the Security Studies Program. Barry Posen, great to have you back.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Andy.
So here we are. It's been a very rough stretch. Well, we've all been watching hurricanes, the U.S. on a big offensive, and I hope to hear from Michael Ware on that in Tal Afar on the Syrian border, an al-Qaeda insurgent stronghold, and then insurgents hitting back in Baghdad and beyond, some of the bloodiest days since the invasion as a result of bombings. Andrew Krepinevich, you say we should hang in, but you say it's not going well at all, and we need a new strategy. First, what's your assessment of where Iraq and the effort there stands right now?
Well, Tom, I think we're at a point where we have a stalemate. Obviously, we're not making great progress in terms of defeating the insurgency. On the other hand, the insurgents obviously aren't going to push us out militarily. What they're trying to do is wear down our will to persist.
Andrew, if I may, and forgive me for this, but our phone line has just come through to Baghdad, where we've got an on-the-ground report. Let me come back to that, if I may,
certainly,
and turn now to Michael Ware, Time Magazine's Iraq Bureau Chief. He writes this week about a ferocious and ultimately inconclusive U.S. offensive in Tal Afar, a town on the Syrian border, a longtime insurgent stronghold. Michael Ware, I'm glad we got you. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Michael, as I understand it, you were in Tal Afar. You saw the American offensive there with Iraqis at their side. What did it look like? How effective was it? What did you learn? What did we learn from it?
Look, this was the largest fight since the Battle of Fallujah last year. U.S. and Iraqi forces marshaled an assault force of 7,000 troops. Mostly Iraqis, which is the difference from Fallujah last year.
Right.
Hundreds of tanks, Bradleys, jets, everything. They went into Tal Afar, which has become an al-Qaeda stronghold. There was local groups who were there fighting the Americans as, to their eyes, freedom fighters. They were hijacked by al-Qaeda. This was a throw-down affair. These guys did not give up the city easily. We had to fight the elements that I was with, U.S. Special Forces from First Group and Iraqi Army units backed by U.S. Armor, had to battle for 4 days to get into the city, only then to be stopped for 4 more days while political wrangling destroyed the momentum of the offensive and gave al-Qaeda the oxygen it needed to wither away back into the shadows.
So
you're right. The conclusion was inconclusive.
let us look at the two pieces of this. First, the battle piece, then we'll turn to the politics. You say it took 4 days to get into the city. That, with all the equipment that the U.S. military can throw at it, and with 7,000 troops, why so difficult? What does it say about the fighting capacity of the insurgents?
Look, you know, these battles don't come easily. This urban terrain, particularly in Talifah, is suited for the defender. That's the insurgent. U.S. forces were able to move into the city on day one, but they could not take it. You have to earn the right to seize this kind of territory. So these guys were well defended. They were well organized. They knew what they were doing. I mean, in the months leading up to this battle, the American forces in Salafah had taken significant casualties. The platoon I was with alone has suffered 33% casualty rate.
Wow.
That's one in three guys killed or wounded. Tanks got blown up. Helicopters got shot down. I mean, you don't do these things overnight when you go in to take them on.
And yet, on the strategy front, you're quoting soldiers saying, this is a war of inches. People saying this enemy is not a rabble. What's the sense of the troops you're with? When they're on the ground, do they think it's hard, but we're winning? Or do they think it's hard, we're dying, and it's not working?
Look, the reality is, as the previous speaker was saying, I mean, the West, the coalition, there's no question they are not winning this war. The only question that remains right now is, are they losing it? I mean, this is not a war that is being fought on the battlefield. This is being fought on the television screen. This is what the insurgents first told me back in the summer of 2003. We know we can't defeat the Americans militarily, but we can withstand the blood loss far longer than their political will to endure it. These men quote Ho Chi Minh, General Vo Nguyen Giap, Che Guevara. And now that a pure military fight fought by the remnants of Saddam's army has been hijacked more and more every day by al-Qaeda, the very nature of this war is changing. It is intensifying. It is strengthening al-Qaeda. And now we are seeing it internationalize. What Afghanistan was during the Soviet occupation, the blooding ground for a generation of al-Qaeda, that is what Iraq has become today, the blooding ground of the next generation of al-Qaeda.
Michael Ware, there in Baghdad, we thought at least the U.S. was on the same side here as the Iraqi president, but you say he held up the final move on Tal Afar for 4 days, allowing the al-Qaeda, the insurgents there, essentially to slip away. Why?
Look, that's a very complicated situation, but to put it simply, this Iraqi prime minister needs the credibility to show his people that he is a strong leader, that he can win a fight against the insurgents. He was very nervous before this offensive. He could not afford it to play badly domestically. In fact, at his insistence, the battle was delayed for 24 hours.
Because he didn't... Because he didn't want another Fallujah? He didn't want that scene of a city flattened? Is that the reason?
It's part of that. It's also that he couldn't affect, to his mind, he could not afford a loss or a draw. He needed a decisive victory that he could sell to his people to say that I'm as strong as the previous Prime Minister, Alawi. And in midway through the battle, he lost his nerve. And General Casey had to brief him repeatedly every day to assure him that we're going to crush these guys. But another thing about this Prime Minister.
Yes.
He had every interest in the world in seeing al-Qaeda crushed. There was no sympathy here. This plays into a much broader dynamic here in Iraq as well. Not only is al-Qaeda being strengthened by our presence here, but so is Iran. Saddam was the last great counterbalance to them in this region. By removing him, the door was open to Iran. Who do you think this government is really allied with? This government is dominated by Shiite, Iranian-backed parties, from the Prime Minister down. The U.S. Embassy is constantly running into battles with this. So is the U.S. military. So in no means is this Iraqi Prime Minister a true friend of America or American interests.
Michael Ware in Baghdad, let me ask you, we're going to be talking about strategy this hour, but you've been with the American troops, and we care a lot about them. What's your sense of their morale in the middle of this very difficult situation?
Look, the American soldiers, from the specialists sitting in a gun turret to the battalion commanders out there on the front line in the field to your special forces operating out there in the shadows, they're all pros. You know, a lot of National Guardsmen and women are here too. For them, this is something that's different. Nonetheless, they all know they have a job to do. But I have to tell you, I've been here since before the invasion, during the invasion, and ever since. I'm seeing troops coming back who I saw in 2003. Their life is very different now. The fight we had in 2003 was kindergarten compared to what we've got now. I've got troops who pumped full of success in 2003, will remain here, and they will fight for every inch they can get today. But I can tell you, they really wonder what it is they're actually doing.
Michael Ware,
they really wonder what it is they're actually achieving.
Michael Ware, in Baghdad, we appreciate your frontline reporting there and your time with us today. Thank you very much for joining us.
My great pleasure. Take care.
Time Magazine, Iraq Bureau Chief Michael Ware. We are looking in this hour for a realistic way out of a bad situation in Iraq. Stay or go. It seems we need a new strategy. What should it be? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are looking in this hour for a realistic way out of a bad situation in Iraq. Stay or go. We're looking for a new strategy. You can join the conversation with a U.S. death toll, now over 1,900, and an insurgency unabated. What's not working? And should the U.S. stay or go? And if it stays, what should it do differently? Are you prepared for a 10-year, hundreds of billions, many more lives strategy if it would work? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined today in the studio by Barry Posen, professor of political science at MIT. He's with the Security Studies Program there, author of The Sources of Military Doctrine. And from Washington by Andrew Krepinevich, executive director of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He's professor at George Mason University, been making a big noise with his strategy advice on Iraq. Andrew Krepinevich, unless you've got something to add, I think we got a pretty good update on where things stand there from Michael Ware. You say no strategy will bring about an end to the insurgency quickly or easily, but you're presenting something you call the best of a bad lot, a strategy you say will take a decade, hundreds of billions of dollars, many more U.S. casualties, but it's the price the U.S. must pay if it's going to achieve a worthy goal in Iraq. What is it compared to what we're doing now? What's going wrong now? What do you suggest as a change?
Well, I think Michael did lay out the challenge before us. I would put this in context when you think about the strategy and the price you might be willing to pay. The Bush administration, although I don't think it's done a very good job of elaborating on the issue, really has pushed a lot of our political chips to the middle of the table in this war.
What do you mean by that?
What the administration is trying to do in terms of its strategic objective is incredibly ambitious. It is trying to offer a third way to disgruntled Muslim people between the despotism that characterizes governments in the Arab world and the extremism that is really the only alternative that a lot of these young Muslims see to that despotism.
Why isn't the effort working so far?
Third way is creating a democracy. And quite frankly, it's very ambitious. And as we're seeing, we're struggling. I don't think there's any set of metrics that you can employ that would indicate that we're making dramatic progress. And so the question is this objective still realistic? If it's not, do we have a fallback position? And then finally, aside from the cost of achieving our objectives, what is the cost of defeat? Because I think a number of people sort of view this as a war of choice. And maybe it was in March of 2003, but at this point, it's not like Haiti. It's not like Somalia. It's not a war that you can walk away with, I don't think, without some significant consequences for this country's security.
I want to get into the details here. I know you're where you're coming from. You're saying we've got to stick this out because the stakes are so high and that it hasn't been right so far, and you've got a plan for how it might be done differently. We're struggling, you say. Why? What have been the strategic or tactical errors that have left us struggling? Was it necessary? Was that foreordained?
No, I think, again, people have talked about this, the failure really to plan for so-called phase four operations. What would you do in the wake of Saddam Hussein's disposition? And from what I've seen so far, too much of the effort has focused on both defeating the enemy on the battlefield, which works in conventional war, but doesn't work particularly when you're fighting a counterinsurgency. Put in simplest terms, we have overwhelming combat power in Iraq. If we know who the insurgents are and where they are, we can win this war very quickly. The problem is you have to win the intelligence battle. You have to get that information. The source of that information, principally, is the Iraqi people themselves. When are they going to give you that information? When they have a stake in a democratic Iraqi government, and when they feel secure enough so that they can provide support to the government in the form of information and intelligence in a way that won't leave themselves open to retribution on the part of the insurgents.
The Pentagon,
so what does that mean?
Yes, what does that mean?
That means when you conduct an operation in a place like Tal Afar, you cannot walk away from that city say, well, we killed so many insurgents, and now we'll go back to conducting other operations.
Is that what we're doing now?
That's, I think, one of the big questions, and I suspect that is, unfortunately, what we may be in the process of doing. And what that leads you to is a situation where the situation has changed as long as you're there, and when you walk away, the situation reverts to its earlier condition. It's like putting your fist in a bucket of water. And the circumstances change as long as your fist is in that bucket. When you pull it out, it's the same old bucket of water.
What's the alternative?
The alternative, and this is nothing particularly novel, it's the way that insurgencies have been defeated in the past, is to, when you take an area, to stay there, and begin to train up local police forces, to stay there for as long as it takes to train those forces. By providing security, you enable reconstruction, and reconstruction that sticks, not reconstruction that is sabotaged once you leave. And over time, the intent is, and the experience has been, as people begin to see their lives improving, as they begin to see security return to their neighborhoods, their town, their city, they have a stake. They now have a stake because life is getting better for them in your success. And they begin to feel secure enough. If I walk down to the police station and I point out who in our neighborhood has been cooperating with the insurgents, I'm not afraid that when I go home that night, there'll be somebody waiting for me to do me in.
Sounds so simple, but looks so hard on the ground. We'll talk about how and whether that might work. But I want to ask you, by your own assessment, what the price tag is there. You write, even if successful, this strategy would require at least a decade of commitment and hundreds of billions of dollars, and will result in longer U.S. casualty rolls. What's the bill? What's the price tag for the strategy you're proposing?
Well, the price tag is hard to define. The burn rate, as they call it, in terms of our monetary expense in Iraq right now, is about $5 billion a month. So that's roughly $60 billion a year. Now, again, if you were successful over time, you wouldn't maintain 140,000 troops in Iraq. And I think if you pursued a more effective strategy, you could actually reduce the current force levels and still be more effective on the ground. But what you're talking about, Tom, is not only adopting this process, but you're also talking about winning politically, and that is every bit as difficult. In the article I wrote about the need for a grand bargain, what you need to do is try and determine, and we've done this to some extent with success in Afghanistan, is can you find among the disparate groups of Iraqis, the Shia, the Kurds, the Sunnis, enough people who have a stake in a democratic Iraq where they're free from external Iranian influence, where the Kurds don't have to worry about the Turks and the Iranians breathing down on their neck, where the Sunnis don't have their former role, but they can accept that because they do have some significant political role in the life of the country. That is not going to happen quickly. We need to find out if that can happen, and that's what Ambassador Khalilzad, I think, is trying to do right now.
The new U.S. ambassador there, and we feel that effort, but we also see what a monumental task that is, and not least around the recent constitutional effort there. We see the big framework you're laying out here. You call it an oil spot strategy. That is, the oil spot where the parts of the country you've secured, and you button them up, make them secure, win support by having a better life within them, and then build out from there rather than going out and trying to just get a kill number on insurgents. Take areas and stay there. Make them work as the heart of a new, more stable, secure Iraq. There's a lot more to say there, but I want to get Barry Posen in this conversation. Barry, will that work?
It probably won't work. I think Andy's right that this is probably a better strategy and a more promising strategy. If you take as your prior that you're going to be there for many more years for whatever reasons, and you should probably try this strategy. But the strategy is probably not going to work.
Why
the
not?
Reason it's not going to work is because my own view is that Andy misunderstands the nature of the opposition to the Americans in Iraq. Many people who talk about counterinsurgency strategy talk about winning hearts and minds. Andy has a strategy that focuses basically on the minds of the adversary to try and show them some things about costs and some things about benefits. But there's almost no understanding about the hearts of the adversary and almost no understanding that winning the hearts of this adversary is probably impossible.
So he wants to make it clear to the insurgency that they cannot win.
He wants to make it clear. Andy believes that there's a large mass of fence sitters, particularly among the Sunni Arab population, mm-hmm. who are just waiting to join up with the current government and waiting to join up with the Americans if we can only show them that they're safe,
yes.
and that their lives are going to be better.
As he says,
right?
Yes.
And the question is, why should we believe this? I mean, the circumstantial evidence doesn't support this. I mean, what we have in Iraq is 5 million Sunni Arabs who formerly were at the top of the food chain in this country and are now at the bottom of the food chain. Right. So this is called status reversal. And when a group like this suffers status reversal, very intense emotions are aroused.
They were cock of the roost. They were the big deal, and now they're out.
Yeah, and they resent it. And from their point of view, right, they faced many internal challenges from the other members of society, which they successfully thwarted.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason in their story of their loss that they're not on top anymore is the Americans. So the Americans are the agents of their status reversal. So they have very profound resentment towards the Americans across this population.
And you don't think they're going to think that away. In fact, if I understand what you're saying, Barry, you're saying America should get out and let the overwhelming majority of Shiites kind of kick the tail ends of the Sunnis because that's the only way they're going to learn that they've lost their top slot. Is that right?
I believe we need an alternative strategy. Andy and I totally agree on that, right? I believe that the Krebinevit strategy, the oil spot strategy, is a strategy for staying in Iraq. My own sense is that Andy, as conservative as he is about the cost, and he's being very honest about cost,
yes.
I think he's still not being honest enough about time and cost and risks and ways that this could go wrong. So I believe you need an alternative strategy, and my alternative strategy would be to find a way to lessen the American footprint in Iraq very, very significantly. Right?
Down to from 150,000 down to what?
A few thousand.
A few, under 10.
I don't even like to think of
okay,
it that
but
way.
A few thousand doing what?
Don't talk about individuals and bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about strategy.
Yes, okay.
Right?
That's right? Why we're here.
Heretofore, the Americans want to try and control these places from the inside out. I think we're bad at controlling places from the inside out. We have to try and control this place from the outside in. We have to
from
use,
over the horizon.
We have to use coercion. We have to use people in the society whose views about us will change once we're not there. We have to coerce people in the region into helping us or bribe them into helping us. These are the things we have to do. And those things, and you can't do those things as long as we appear to be the agents of what the Arab world historically resents the most, which is Western domination and, more importantly, Western occupation of Arab societies. So we are energizing nationalism against us, and nationalism is one of the most powerful forces in modern politics. We've got to find a way to let the air out of that balloon.
I want to get Andrew Krepinevich's response to that, but let me just ask you one thing first. Does that mean, then, retreat to a few thousand Americans somewhere and say, bring on the Civil War, and then we pick up the pieces? We manipulate from afar? Is that essentially as a strategist? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. My own view is as unconventional as it may be, is that a big problem in Iraq is that we have three groups, and those three groups have no way to compellingly measure their power and their will relative to one another.
That is Sunni, Shia, Kurds.
Sunni, Shia, and Kurds. So as long as we are there, we can see what's happened. The Kurds and the Shia ask too much because they know we will defend what they ask.
Right.
Because they ask too much, the Sunnis get too little. Right? So the Sunnis don't see this compromise, this grand bargain that Andy is talking about. Second, as long as we're there waging the fight, right, the Sunnis don't know that they actually lost the battle for control of Iraq. There has to be something that approximates a fair fight between Shiites, Kurds, and Sunnis, so the Sunnis learn, A, they are a minority, and B, they can't win.
Okay, let's hold it there. Andrew Krepinevich, Barry Posen says it's a lousy situation. He agrees with you there. He says the bottom line is you got to let them have at it to figure out their new reality. But his critique of your security zone or oil spot strategy is that it relies on the Sunni to buy in. And while it may make sense intellectually, maybe at some point, they won't do it as a matter of the heart. What do you say to that?
Well, as usual, Barry makes a great many, number of good points. My response would be that ultimately this is about a test of wills. The Sunnis are betting that we'll get tired and we'll go away. And really, unlike what Michael Ware said there, they may be quoting Mao and Ho Chi Minh, but what they're really looking for is a Leninist kind of revolution. They're betting that in the chaos that might ensue following an American departure, because they would be more disciplined, because they might have a greater level of external support, most of the Arab world is Sunni, that they would win in that power scrum.
A small core could carry the day.
Right. Of course, the question is, well, I guess there's two questions. One is, would such a power scrum work in terms of our security interests, number one? And, of course, you'd lose any chance of developing sort of a third-way alternative the way the Bush administration is talking about, and that's a subject for debate. But, again, what you'd pose to people in the Muslim world is you've got a choice between despotism and radicalism. Second, I think you certainly would convey to the radical Islamists the kind of boost that they had when they argue they drove the Soviets out of Afghanistan. So I think that problem might likely worsen. The downside, and I'm not saying this is a certainty, but you could see a kind of slow motion 1914 where something that seems little begins to expand and grow. And again, I'm not saying this is a certainty, but certainly the consequences would be dramatic for our country. If you think you don't like paying $3 a gallon for gasoline now, recognize that this is going on in a part of the world that has 40% of the world's proven oil reserves. I do agree with Barry that we've got to, I would call it, rebalance the three keys to winning this war. And the other two, besides the Iraqi people, are the American military and the American people. We've got to reduce our troop footprint, number one, because we're wearing out the army, and number two, because I think at some point the American people say, look, this country has a constitution. They've had elections. When are the Iraqis going to start fighting for their own democracy? And we certainly can't get down to, I don't think, a few thousand, but I think we ought to think about a significant reduction in U.S. forces over the next year. The final point I'll make is that this is difficult. There's no question about it. And when you think about it, when people talk about the administration creating a democratic Iraq, well, a democracy is more than voting. It's more than a constitution. Our democracy is rooted on institutions, durable, stable institutions. That is going to take a long time to build in Iraq.
And there comes the 10 years and the hundreds of billions and the lives.
I think that that's a down payment.
Payment. We're talking big, big bills here. Andrew Krepinevich, Barry Posen, we're glad to have you with us. We've got to take a short break here. We've got a mountain of listeners who want to join this conversation. We've kept them waiting. We are looking for a realistic way out of a bad situation in Iraq. Stay or go, a better strategy. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What do you think? Do you believe the right long-haul commitment would work? Are you sure? Are you sure enough to try it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at babsoncapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. As the hurricanes grab the national headlines, we are stepping back to look for a realistic way out of a bad situation in Iraq. Stay or go, something that would take us closer to some light here. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. We're joined in this hour by MIT's Barry Posen at the Security Studies Program there, and by Andrew Krepinevich. His article in Foreign Affairs is How to Win in Iraq. He says, we do not have a coherent strategy right now. We're struggling. It's not working. We need something better. What do you think it ought to be? Ben is calling from Washington, D.C. Ben, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Very interesting conversation. I read Andrew's article, and I thought it was fantastic. I'd just like to inject a little bit of the military strategy into this. There's an underlying assumption here is that we're not adapting to the situation on the ground, and we're not changing our strategy as we go along here.
Ben, let us understand. Are you in the military?
I'm a major in the U.S. Marine Corps. I've got 2 tours in Iraq. I'm heading back for my third one in December. I also speak Arabic and teach Iraqi culture when I'm not in Iraq.
We're impressed. We salute it all. So what do you think is going on?
Well, much more positive than you see on the news, and I've gotten several discussions with my friends in the press about this. But the bottom line is Andy Weiss, you know, had a good point up front when he said that this is a contest of wills. We're going to be there for a little while. There's a middle ground between the two positions here, between civil war and a 10-year long-term 140,000 troop commitment.
What is it?
We have a plan where we're slowly working with the Iraqi military, and we're getting them up to speed, and I think it's going a lot better than you see on the press. Got a friend that just returned from Fallujah. He was embedded with an Iraqi battalion. When he first got there, they were only able to work at the squad level, which is about 13 guys. They're now working independent battalion-level operations.
So you think President Bush's description, our forces will stand down as Iraqi troops stand up, you think that's on track? It's working?
It is working, depending on what your expectations are. If your expectations are an immediate solution to all of our problems within the next 2 months, it's not going to happen.
And when you hear Andrew Krepinevich and Barry Posen say it's not working, I mean, they're not in the press, though Michael Ware is earlier, and he was just in Tal Afar. When you hear them say it's not working, how do you analyze that, Ben?
Well, everything looks very dramatic on the news, and certainly Andy's got a specific angle that he's got from Baghdad and going out to the hot spots from time to time. But I can tell you the hard, grudging, hot work that the guys are doing out there on a daily basis is successful. It's not dramatically successful, and I think that's the difference.
Andrew Krepinevich, can you engage our caller, Ben? He's a Marine major, and he says there's a middle way. Stand down as they stand up, and it's working.
Well, when you talk about substituting Iraqi troops for American troops, I think that's absolutely essential for a number of reasons, some of which Ben mentioned. The question is, how do you use those troops? Do you use them primarily in operations that U.S. forces call whack-a-mole, where you go out hunting for insurgents and you try and kill as many as you can, and then you return to your base? Or do you use them primarily to provide security for the population? I think the former kind of approach leads you to a situation similar to the movie Groundhog Day, where you go out, you kill them, the insurgents continue to recruit from the population, you have to go out again and again and again, as opposed to denying them access to the population, which dries up their source of supply. Having said that, the fact of the matter is that when insurgencies reach this level, it typically takes a long time to defeat them. It takes a long time because it takes a long time to win back the confidence of the people. And we don't have enough forces to provide security for the entire country at once, so it has to be progressive. It has to be along the lines of an oil spot. Secondly, you're talking about, I think, a long-term U.S. military presence for two reasons. One is, you're not going to build democratic institutions in Iraq overnight. And one of the things that's going to keep these people from going at each other's throats is the presence of the U.S. military. Second, when you think about the Iraqi military that we're building, their loyalty right now, as Barry Posen, I think, may have alluded to, is really more to their own group. It was the Kurdish Peshmerga that went into Tal Afar. Their militia wasn't the Iraqi National Army. And think of our own history. In 1861, 72 years after our Constitution, Robert E. Lee still felt more loyal to his fellow Virginians than he did to his country. And so he fought for the South. And this, again, will require I'm not saying 140,000 troops, but as we begin to whittle the insurgency down, it's still going to require somehow another act of diplomacy where the Iraqis see it in their interest to have a residual American military presence for three reasons. One, to help fortify that democracy. Second, to help minimize the subversion that I think Barry and Michael Ware talked about, the Turks, the Iranians, and so on, and the foreign jihadists. And third, the original reason for going to war, which is to not give the Iraqis a feeling that they need to pursue weapons of mass destruction, because wouldn't that be ironic at the end of the day, where we leave, they see the Iranians pursuing the bomb, and they go back and try and pursue it themselves.
Hard to picture something much worse. Major Ben in Washington, how many years do you think the U.S. has the military depth and the political will to hang in Iraq?
Well, I can only speak for the military will, and the military will is certainly there. I'm a professional officer, and I can't speak to political will, but we want to be there. And I can tell you that if we pull out and abandon Iraq, the Civil War, you're going to create a new lost generation of American troops that have put their heart and soul and lives and blood into this thing. And if you think it's going to be a fair fight if we pull out and leave them to Civil War, you get another thing coming.
Major, we appreciate your call. Thanks for being with us in this hour. Let me get another
call.
Yes, Andrew?
I just wanted to comment on that for a second. I think, again, this issue of the American people and their will being key to this war, there is an undercurrent, I think, among some officers, and it's a growing current, that when the administration says this country is at war, that sort of gets the hair on the back of some of these folks' neck to rise. They come back and say, no, this country isn't at war. The American Army and Marine Corps are at war. We're the ones doing the fighting.
Right.
We're the ones doing the dying. Where is the sacrifice being asked of the American people?
And the rest of us are still going to the mall. We got it. I really want to get some of these callers in. John is calling from Amherst, New York. John, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm going to preface this by more or less going along with the major that just spoke. Mm-hmm. What we're having here right now is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Everyone agrees we can't leave Iraq. Everyone agrees that Saddam Hussein was a bad man. Saddam Hussein not only was one of these despots that your guests speak of, what he also was a harbinger of terrorists. He paid Palestinians $25,000.
Yep.
I'm not going to refight that war, Tom.
So where are you going? First of all, I should say not everyone agrees we can't leave Iraq. I mean, you've got all kinds of retired military people. You've got Barry Posen with us this morning. But still, Americans wonder what the heck we should do. Where do you come down, John?
Well, I am not. We hear that Al-Qaeda is there. Why is Al-Qaeda in Iraq? Simply for the exact reason that George Bush went into Iraq. In order to establish democracy, the biggest fear that Al-Qaeda has is that we will have a foothold of people, free-thinking people, similar to what we had in the changing of transformation of Russia, which now, unfortunately, is going back to where it was.
So stay or go. What's your answer, John?
Well, we have to stay there. But, I mean, I'm just amazing that we're having a self-fulfilling prophecy. So Osama bin Laden, years ago, and I'm sure your guests will agree, he said that the Americans will lose their will. We lost 17 people in the historic, Black Hawk Down incident.
And now we went from Somalia. John, we've got it. I want to get another caller here, if I may, from Virginia. Al is calling. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Hello. I've been listening to the previous speakers, and I'm just amazed. After 30 years in the Army, I have to disagree with the major. Certainly as a Marine, he has, certainly done his duty in Iraq, but he came back on tours. The insurgents are still there, and they will be there until either they're killed or we pull out.
Where do you think we're headed here, Al? How do you read it?
I read it as George Bush has already laid it down. He said that we're not going to leave because at that time, 1,700 battle casualties had taken place and we weren't going to lose those people. What the American people say is how many people is it going to take before we leave there? And the number is going to be 60,000. In Korea it was 60,000. In Vietnam it was 60,000. And I just don't understand why we're doing this. We are never going to establish a democracy in Iraq.
Al, we hope you're wrong. Our time is short. We thank you for your call. Barry Posen, that is a grim picture, the idea of us kind of putting the spade in to dig another memorial in Washington, another deep, black, shiny wall with 50,000, 60,000 names on it. Our earlier Marine caller said there's a middle way here, and it's working. They will stand up, and we will stand down, and let's stick with that. And if you don't, you're going to disillusion a generation of the American military. How do you respond, Barry?
I think a good bit of the American military is already disillusioned, as many people who talk with them. That's not the same as saying that they're defeatist, right? The American military is very professional. You send them out there to do the job. They try and do the job. This is true of officers and enlisted people. But there's an undercurrent of unease about this issue that was raised earlier about who is exactly at war. I mean, it's pretty clear the American people are at hurricane, and they're at hurricane relief in a much more emotional way, in a much more committed way, in a much more participatory way than any thing that has to do with the war in Iraq, right? And if the president had found a way to tap one-tenth of that kind of emotion for support for this war, public, widespread public support, some way of contribution, some understanding of what is happening, some emotional identification, then people would be more confident of their ability to stay the course. But they were unable to do that, and I think one of the reasons they're unable to do it is because the story is incredibly complicated, and the promise at the end of the rainbow is very diffuse and not believable. Right. So we need a realistic goal in Iraq. And I don't believe Andy's goal of this grand bargain is in any way realistic. What's realistic in Iraq, sadly, is Bosnia. That's what's realistic, right?
Divide.
You achieve some kind of stalemate, which you manage from the outside. And then when people are really tired and really needy, you impose an outcome that basically involves a weak central state, right, and accommodation because people are being bribed and paid off.
Can you see this administration coming to that conclusion, given the price tag that's being laid out there today?
It's very difficult to know because they're very cagey about revealing their true beliefs about things, right? I think the path of least resistance politically, in a strange and very tragic way, is that they continue to do what they're doing. They may pick one town and try Andy's strategy like Baghdad, which will make everything look a lot better if he can make it work, right? But I don't expect this thing to change very much. And that's the real tragedy.
And on we go with that price tag. Well, I want to thank all of you for really opening our eyes this morning. Andrew Krepinevich, you remind us that the American public is one of the big players on this battlefield. There's no way out of that. There are decisions to be made politically here, and we appreciate your enlightening us on your view of what those ought to be. Thanks very much, Tom, for being with us. Barry Posen, always great to have you. Thanks for coming in. To continue this conversation, go to onpointradio.org, click on forums. In a moment, the latest on Hurricane Rita. This is On Point. If there was a Category 6, Rita would be there, said one meteorologist, tracking the monster storm today, packing 170-plus mile-an-hour winds, and with Galveston in her sights, Hurricane Rita is now forecast to make landfall on Saturday. More than 1 million residents of Texas and Louisiana have already evacuated. Oil companies have shut down refineries, including two of the nation's largest near Houston. Terry Langford is a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. She joins me from Port Lavaca on the Texas coast. Terry, thanks for being with us. What do you see there at this hour?
I see quite the opposite of what we saw in New Orleans, which was a sort of frantic last-minute evacuation. What we're seeing in Texas is very orderly, although there are lines snaking through the highways and roads of Texas right now. It's pretty calm. Most of the people here in Port Lavaca have already gotten out, and the last few residents who do want to get out are getting out now.
Place Port Lavaca for us. Where is it in relation to Houston, Galveston?
It's about 120 miles southwest of Houston. Normally about a two-hour drive to get down here, and last night it took me about seven.
We spoke with you a great deal when the evacuation was going on from the Gulf over toward Louisiana and Mississippi when people were pouring into Texas. Now they're pouring out of Texas, or at least away from the coast. Where are they going?
They're going to San Antonio mostly, which is a couple of hours inland, and they're going to places like Victoria. A lot of them are going to Dallas, which is, from Houston would be a four-hour drive north. Many people are going to Dallas, and hotels have just been they're full.
And what about the evacuees from New Orleans and the Louisiana-Mississippi Gulf Coast who are in Texas? What kind of facilities are they headed for?
Well, they're heading, some of them were in hotels, and I've heard from colleagues up and down the coast, some of them were in hotels along the coast here. Now they're having to evacuate again and move inland.
And this evacuation from the Texas coast, is this typical, or because of the example of Katrina right in front of us and this very high rating here, of Force 5, do you see more people clearing out than usual, more than ever?
Oh, yes, more than ever. Texas is no stranger to storms. We've had Carla in 61. We've had Alicia in 83. But what we're seeing now is a wake-up call that Katrina provided. That and residents who remember as children Carla coming through here in 100-mile-per-hour winds and the flooding then. So people are getting out because of the history and also the wake-up call that Katrina provided.
And, of course, Galveston absolutely flattened in 1900 by the infamous hurricane.
Right, and this area, actually, not very, very close to this area, was wiped out in the 1800s from the storm.
What about the petroleum industry, the refineries? We saw the hit that they took on the Louisiana coast. How vulnerable are people saying they are on the Texas coast? There's even more there.
Well, there are. They are some of them are in shutdown mode. Another thing that has the overly cautious, I would say, mandatory evacuation orders that are going out in Texas shuts down a lot of the gas stations, even the ones that do have gas. So it's making getting inland tricky because you've got so much gas and you don't know if you're going to have enough to make it through the long traffic lines.
So tricky for the traffic jams right now and maybe tricky for the nation next week if this slams right into those refineries.
Yes.
Terry, what's your plan for this storm? When do you expect it now to hit where you are? What's the latest you know and how do you plan to cover it?
Well, the latest we know is it's still, from what I hear, going towards Galveston, which, like I said, is over 100 miles north of me. But the winds are so big, it's expected to flood and be up down here also. I will probably head a little bit inland either tonight or tomorrow. That's the plan for now. We've got reporters up and down the coast and several in Galveston right now.
You and millions of others on the move. Terry, thank you very much for being with us. Hope we can keep up with you as the storm progresses. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Terry Langford, a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. She spoke with me from Port Lavaca on the Texas coast. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.